Hi, I'm Misty Hayes, and this is RetroTech. I'm here at the Microsoft Archives, and today I'll be talking with the famous Larry Osterman.
Hi, Misty.
Hi, Larry. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
What's the one piece of Microsoft software or hardware you wish would come back and why?
Microsoft Activates Barney. We got one of those for our kids when they were, you know, yay high. They were the coolest thing ever. Little animatronic Barney that you could interact with, that was just like so cool. Older hardware, honestly, I wish we'd bring back some of our older style keyboards. The wireless keyboard 5000, some of the older school. I'd like it if Microsoft continued or started making ambidextrous mice again, because I'm left-handed and strongly right-handed mice are a pain in the neck.
If you could pair a program with anyone, who would it be and why?
If I had a chance to pair a program with anybody? Actually, I think it would be fascinating pair programming with Raymond. I think that would be an interesting experience, Raymond Chen. Just because I think that, because he can be quite volatile, as can I, and I think it would be an interesting opportunity to see, because the two of us really do have rather different styles. The 90s were all about total quality management, and that was sort of the overwhelming hot newness was integrated testing and code coverage to ensure that you had every possible code path in your development org covered and ensuring that there were quality metrics for everything. And then and waterfall. Everything waterfall. Extreme programming, XP. And there were a lot of things that came out of XP that I thought were amazing. Test-driven development, I think, it literally changed the way I've written software. I used to do the more traditional, oh god, I gotta write tests, oh really, oh I don't want to have to write tests. And I, for a particular feature I was working on in Windows 7, I said, hey, what the heck, I'll try TDD, I'll try test-driven methodologies. And I did. And I wrote the exhaustive unit tests and the tests ahead of time, and I mocked when I had to, and I finished the feature, and as one did in the time, I handed it over to the test organization and they found two bugs in the entire 6 months that they were testing it. They found two bugs that hadn't been already found by my tests, and they were test cases that I had missed. So I'm like, okay, I'm sold. Yeah. And I've been using it ever since. God, the fancy thing. I forgot about that. And I totally forgot about the dancing baby. Thank you very much for reminding me.
So, yeah, I was thinking about that. I was like, that weird dancing baby was everywhere.
I remember I remember getting my 19-inch monitor. It was so good. It was like the best thing ever. Oh, gosh, the tech toys, getting the big monitor in. And it's a 19-inch monitor. Not that little fiddly little 13-inch monochrome thing. No, it was a full-on 64 color monitor. Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah, but and yeah, that was absolutely the case. And I wrote about this on Twitter many weeks ago about the specs of my first dev machine, which had 800K of RAM. Had a 10 meg hard drive. Actually, sorry, I was a PC-AT, I had 20 meg hard drive.
How do you pronounce it?
Uh-oh.
And so it'll just be like a few words, and I'll give you both options and their tech words. And to hear what you think. So I'll start with the first one. There are just three of them. Is it, how do you pronounce the thing that's spelled S, Q, and L? Is it SQL or SQL?
SQL. And actually, one of my partner teams is the SQL Server team, so I say SQL a lot. It's not squirrel.
Yeah, it's...
I've heard that one, squirrel. Squirrel. Like, no, it's not squirrel.
Data or data?
Data is the name of an android played by Brent Spiner. Data is the thing that we work with on a daily basis.
GIF or JIF?
It's JIF. And I know, JIF's a peanut butter, I don't care. It's also a graphics format.
So what was it like being a programmer when Y2K happened?
Oh my gosh.
What was it like?
I was not, thank goodness, I was not involved directly in that. I mean, I had to do the Y2K audit, because every team in Microsoft did a Y2K audit of all of our code. In the years leading up to it. I know people who were on call during that week, the week between the Y2K and the Y2K1, which people don't talk about as much, but was also of concern. But I know people who were on call, and it was horrific. It was truly grueling, and they were scared witless about what could have happened. So we had people on call, on duty, here in our data centers, etc., ready to deal with the fact that everything could catastrophically go wrong. For me, it was not nearly as traumatic or eventful, because we were... A mandate came down saying audit all your code for to ensure that when your dates are stored, they're stored in a non-BCD form. But since almost all of our structures had been built around either Unix date and time or NT times or other more flexible time formats, this really turned out to be kind of a no-op. I will say I do see 2038 looming up, and that one worries me a little bit, because there is still a fair amount of software that uses 32-bit times, and that epic rolling over, when the Unix time rolls over, that could actually be like real and scary.
I heard that you're a reader, that you read a lot.
Oh gosh,
and,
I read.
And I read a lot too, so I read over 60 books last year. So I wanted to ask you, what are some of your favorite books about tech? And have you read Mythical Man Month?
It's over there on the shelf somewhere. I don't know where. But Mythical Man Month is my Bible. I tell people to use... to be very clear, the book was written in 1965. It was based on the experiences that IBM had building the IBM 360. Everything in that book is as relevant today as it was in 1965. And I tell that to new hires, and I tell them to get the book and to read that, and they walk and they're like, 1965, how could that possibly? Everything in there is still relevant. It is an amazing book. Tech books that I love, love, love. Petzold's Code, which is an intro to digital systems starting from literally the transistor and building yourself all the way up to essentially the elements of a modern operating system. And he walks you through every piece of that construction. Another amazing, amazing tech book is, again, Petzold's Annotated Turing. He takes Alan Turing's seminal thesis, the thing where he actually introduced the concept of the Turing machine, and explains it, puts it in context, and fleshes out the bare mathematics of the story. Those are just like some of my all-time favorite tech books.
If someone made a movie about Microsoft and say you were going to be one of the main people in the movie, who would you want to play you? Like, what actor, who would play Larry?
Oh, that's easy. John Rhys Davies.
So you've thought about it?
No. No, other way around.
Oh, yeah?
People come and they say, oh, you look just like Hagrid.
Really?
You look just like Hagrid. Sure. Okay. Wow. First project I ever worked on, actually, was multitasking MS-DOS 4.0. The project that no one's ever heard of because, well, it never actually saw the light of day unless you were a customer of the post office in France. We had a contract with Goupil, French hardware manufacturer, to produce devices, the operating system for devices that were going to go into the post offices in France. And that was really like one of the very first projects I ever worked on. The fascinating thing was is we got projects going on, it's making progress, and all of a sudden we start getting bug reports as Goupil starts getting the project up and running on their computers. Now, we don't have any of those computers here in Redmond. So we had this big shutdown in 1986 where the entire company shut down for 3 days. And they said, oh wait, the company shut down for 3 days. I know, we'll send Larry and one other developer over to France for the weekend. And we got shipped to work in a office complex in a suburb of Paris for the weekend where we could actually, well, figure out and debug and diagnose the problem on their machines. And since I own the device drivers, all of them for MS-DOS, I was one of the people who had to go. And so I got shipped on an airplane out for a weekend. So Microsoft closed on Thursday night, and everybody else was told to take a one-day holiday. I was put on an airplane to Paris, landed in Paris, spent a day and a half working with the guys from Goupil, and then they shipped me on an airplane back. And so my one trip to France, to Paris even, I got to drive through Paris on the way to the restaurant. That is the entire extent of my tourist experience in Paris, was fixing bugs in an office park outside of Paris.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And the reason why this becomes relevant today is that this was literally when we were moving to the campus. They just finished building the campus that was torn down over the summer. So I was in Paris. They were moving everybody into the new campus, and almost all of those buildings are now a 60-foot hole, deep hole in the ground.
Name a time that you got stuck on some code earlier in your career, and something that you'll never forget, and how you handled it. Can you share a time with us?
Absolutely. This is actually one of my foundational learning experiences that I had working at Microsoft. I was working on a component called the browser, which was the network neighborhood feature of Windows. And it almost worked, but it really wasn't very reliable. And the problem was is that it had to be completely reliable. That every time you typed netview on the command line, or every time you brought up the network control panel page or whatever, the window, it had to show a list of servers. And that was really important. And the thing wasn't really working very well. It was just not very reliable. And
we kept on having people complaining about it, and so eventually my boss at the time said, I hate doing this, but every morning from now on at 8:30 in the morning, we are going to have a meeting. And you are going to give me a report of everything that happened, of every failure, and the root cause of that failure in the browser for the previous 24 hours. So I'd written a tool which monitored the state of the service, and it simulated traffic constantly, measured it. I had a mean time that they couldn't have anything take more than 300 milliseconds to respond with a complete list of servers. And I reported out every single failure to my boss at 8:30 in the morning, which meant, of course, that I was at work at 6 a.m. collecting the results so that I could give the root cause on every one of them, fix them, iterated on it. Eventually, it became clear that one of the problems I had was in the network stack, so the person who owned the network stack had to come in, and they got to deal with the same 8:30 meeting, and that went on for about 6 months. And through a lot of iteration and a lot of work, the service became reliable. We made changes, we made design changes, we did a whole bunch of stuff, but eventually we finally got it to the point where the thing was actually working almost completely reliably. And it was stressful. I still wake up in the morning, and as I'm showering, I sit there and it runs through my head, I wonder what the browser checker results were for this morning. Now, it's been 30 years since this, but that the browser checker, which was the tool I'd written to monitor things, checking the browser checker results is still something that goes through my head every morning. Even though, of course, that code's no longer in Windows, but it doesn't matter. On the other hand, I learned so much about what it takes to actually build and deliver a real honest-to-goodness service that's reliable, that I'll never forget the lessons I learned from.
So Larry, I'm curious, what are your favorite extensions in the IDE that you use?
Extensions? What are those? I use the Team Explorer. That's an extension, I think. I can't think of anything else. Now, but my preferred IDE is actually a text editor that I have been using since 1984 called Epsilon, that was written by, it turns out, two college classmate mates of mine from Pittsburgh, and I'm still using it after 30-odd years, and it's still my favorite. It runs on my machine all the time. It's my go-to editor for text editing. Nowadays, because I'm working in Azure, almost all the stuff I do is in Visual Studio, but I don't do extensions because, frankly, honestly, I don't know what extensions there are that are, like, interesting and useful. So I just use the vanilla Visual Studio because it mostly works.
So Larry, what are some favorite productivity hacks that you have when you write code?
I don't have any. So here's the thing. I have a stupid memory. It's like why my family doesn't play Trivial Pursuit at all, ever. And I memorize all sorts of stupid, useless things. So for instance, productivity hacks, like source code browsing, stuff like that. I don't need a source code browser because I know where every function in the code I work on lives. I know what file it's in. I know more or less where it is inside the file. I used to do this in Windows, and I'd be jumping around from one component to another, and people were like, how do you... They're using various editors that have really good source browsing capability. How do you use this old school editor with no source browsing at all? I'm like, because I just know where the code is. It's only a couple of 100,000 lines of code. It's not that much, right? And honestly, that's the thing. Does using WinDBG to debug native code when Visual Studio doesn't allow me to debug native code, does that count as a productivity hack? I don't usually think of it as, I think of that as whatever's necessary to get my job done. And that's not, you know, it's not a trick, it's not an anything, it's, you know, oh look, I want to know why my component's slow. Okay, I'll launch, I'll collect an ETW log with kernel calls, with call stacks on it, and I'll load it up in Purview, and I'll take a look at the call traces. I don't think of that as, I think of that as just that's the job. I don't think of that as a hack per se, because that's usually like some, this one cool trick that you can do that just makes your life great. I've not found any cool tricks that just make your life wonderful. I really haven't. Set them up so that they auto-hide, so you don't have to worry about anything except for those the 16 pixel wide column. They just disappear off your IDE screen. And then you've got tests on the left, you've got Solution Explorer on the right, and you're fine. Oh, and debug output windows and the debug output window and the watch local variables auto is on the bottom. That's it. And then you've got everything else is your code. So again, I don't think of that as a productivity hack. And I don't know why anybody would move their Solution Explorer to the left. It just always goes to the right. It's just easier that way. But again, vanilla. I don't do fancy schmancy customizations because vanilla.
If computers took over the world, what would Larry do?
You want the serious answer or the flip answer? I'll give you both. I'll give you either or both. Serious answer. It's a variant of that, which is, what would you have done if you hadn't found computers as a sophomore in high school? It's a variant of they would, you know, what do you do when they're all done? And the answer is I'd probably be a lawyer. Maybe not happy with it, but it's the family business. So, it's what you do. It's the family business, it's what you do. Computers take over the world. I'm sure I could find some nice land up in Idaho and live off the grid. Because honestly, I don't want to live in that world. Because they already have too many computers are already too involved in day-to-day mission decisions. And I've been working with them for so long that I know how really crappy they are at doing things. And so, no. I don't want to live in the world where computers have taken over the world. It's just not a place I'd like to be, because it's not going to be a fun place.
On that note, what would you do? This is what would Larry do. So what would you do if, say, we humans had to, like, what if computers and AI and robots and technology band together and said, we want to fight the humans? What would you do if we were in a war with computers?
Cower in my armored bunker under my house? I literally have no idea. I am not built to be John Connor fighting Skynet. That's just not who I am. Sorry, exactly. That, yes, exactly. That image. No. This is a thing that is not a thing that should be. So, no, that is not a thing. And so, I don't know. Maybe I'd actually finally figure out how to actually be an effective, competent hacker. I've been living and dabbling in security for decades, but I've never actually figured out how to actually do pen testing in any kind of meaningful sense of the world. So maybe I'd actually figure out how to do that. I don't know. I'm sure I'd figure out something.
So Larry, what was your least favorite feature?
Funny you should ask that. So back in Exchange 2000, somebody got the really clever idea that it would be really amazing if they designed a way so that the file system, so like type command on the command line, could actually access the contents of the Exchange data store. So you could like do a dir in a directory and see all of your email messages. And you could use the type command and say type a file, your email, and you'd get the email message typed out on the console. And they thought this was the most amazing idea ever. And it got greenlit, and it was built. And it demoed unbelievably well. And just imagine a salesperson walking in with a customer and saying, oh, and by the way, look at this amazing cool feature we've added to Exchange 2000. You can actually access your email message store as if it was a file system. Unfortunately, the problem is that people actually tried to use their Exchange message store as a file system. And it turns out there's a lot of things that don't necessarily work too well. The first problem they ran into was, oh wait, they took over a drive letter, M:. But it turns out there's a lot of people out there with 25, 30 disks on their machine. Their M:, was a physical hard drive on their server, and they didn't appreciate losing their physical hard drive for this feature that they weren't necessarily going to use. The next problem was antivirus. They started running antivirus programs against the M drive. Because it's, look at that, it's antivirus is an email. It's just running against the problem is that anti-malware programs use all sorts of cool tricks that require huge amounts of compatibility. And the Exchange Message Store, the actual underlying database that holds your email messages, wasn't exactly built for that. So, again, there was a whole series of interesting problems. One of my favorites, this is actually why it is my least favorite, is that I owned the security, the actual access control mechanism for the message store, and I'd just rewritten it for Exchange 2000, huge amounts of work, and then this file system access feature comes along and people get like, wait, the ACLs that you've put on this folder don't look right. I'm like, that's correct, because they work differently. Oh, but no, they have to look like Windows ACLs. They have to behave like Windows file system ACLs, not like Exchange Message Store ACLs. And I'm like, no, because our Exchange email client customers expect it to work a different way. But ACL editor, it's got to work. So we ended up having to find workarounds for that, and it made life insanely complicated. But man, it was a cool feature.
Thank you, Larry, for joining us. It has been a pleasure.
Absolutely, and I mean, I love doing this stuff, and I love talking to people. So, yeah, it's been fun.